Welcome to a special edition of KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We're going to spend almost all of this hour reacting to this morning's inaugural address from President Donald Trump. We are opening our phone lines to you right now, 206-543-5869, 543-5869. I'll play back some parts of Trump's speech. You tell me what you heard. The text of the speech is at our website, KUOW.org, so we got a fact check there as well, KUOW.org. Listen, read, and translate Trump right now at 206-543-5869. My guests are best-selling writer and filmmaker Sherman Alexie, former Washington Attorney General Republican Rob McKenna, and the managing editor of the Northwest News Network, Phyllis Fletcher. Welcome, everybody.
Hey, thanks.
Afternoon.
Yeah, afternoon. Should we translate some Trump? Here's a recap of the speech. After thanking the Obamas for being gracious and magnificent during the transition, the president painted a bleak picture of the country left to us by unnamed politicians in Washington, D.C.
Their victories have not been your victories. Their triumphs have not been your triumphs. And while they celebrated in our nation's capital, there was little to celebrate for struggling families all across our land.
President Trump said Americans want great schools, safe neighborhoods, and good jobs, but for too many of our citizens, a different reality exists.
Mothers and children trapped in poverty in our inner cities, rusted out factories scattered like tombstones across the landscape of our nation, an education system flush with cash, but which leaves our young and beautiful students deprived of all knowledge. And the crime, and the gangs, and the drugs that have stolen too many lives and robbed our country of so much unrealized potential. This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
Then, turning from the American carnage, President Trump painted a glowing vision of our future.
We will bring back our jobs. We will bring back our borders. We will bring back our wealth. And we will bring back our dreams. We will build new roads and highways and bridges and airports and tunnels and railways all across our wonderful nation. We will get our people off of welfare and back to work, rebuilding our country with American hands and American labor.
And the promises continued. We will reinforce old alliances and form new ones.
And unite the civilized world against radical Islamic terrorism, which we will eradicate completely from the face of the earth.
We will completely eradicate radical Islamic terrorism from the face of the earth. Finally, President Trump envisioned an America where we rediscover our loyalty to each other. Quote, a new national pride will stir our souls, lift our sights, and heal our divisions.
And whether a child is born in the urban sprawl of Detroit or the windswept plains of Nebraska, they look up at the same night sky, they fill their heart with the same dreams, and they are infused with the breath of life by the same almighty Creator.
As I say, there are a president's words, and then there's what we hear. On KUOW's Facebook page, Mark says, I heard xenophobia, I heard protectionism, and I heard blaming. John said, good enough for me. He invited us all to unite, and he properly acknowledged the power of the people over their blessedly limited government. Support Trump or not, or in between, how do you interpret his first words as president? We're translating Trump with you right now, the full text at our website, KUOW.org, and our number. Give us a call right now, 206-543-5869, 543-5869. So now, back to our panel, Sherman Alexie, Phyllis Fletcher, Rob McKenna. Sherman, what did you hear from our new president?
Well, I did not
watch it or listen to it live. I'm refusing to give him my ears and eyes. I'm refusing to give him any ratings.
So you're on this show grudgingly for the next hour.
I'm on this show grudgingly. I will help your ratings or hurt them, depending. But I've read the transcript a number of times now, and I've heard some of the highlights. You know, one of the interesting things, there's probably never been given a speech where it's more obvious what he did not write and where he threw in additions as they were working on the speech.
You speak as a writer, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, some of the poetry, the carnage. There is no way that Donald Trump has ever used that word in a sentence. The carnage. I mean, it's very much a speechwriting trope. It's very much an overwrought Hollywood speechwriter trope. So to see him use that word, it's obvious it's not his word. And then there's another point at which he says we will eradicate from the face of the earth. The transcript says eradicate. He added completely eradicate, as if eradicate doesn't already mean completely. So even his redundancies, his oxymorons, that whenever he improvises, he goes into his third grade speech. And I don't even mean to insult third graders by saying that.
What does it say that now we've been saying for months, look, he's not president yet, so people can just talk about his style and his words. But now he is president and your focus is on his eloquence or lack thereof. What does that say for your part in the American fabric that he is stitching to greatness?
I mean, there are people in our lives, we all know them, who, I mean, the thing about him we've heard over and over again, it's how he projects, how he reveals his true nature constantly through his use and misuse of language. And this, what the speech reveals is on one level that he's going to have very little to do with what actually happens in government. And on the other hand, he's going to be so belligerent, so improvisational, so unpredictable that he's going to be dangerous.
Former Attorney General Rob McKenna, what did you hear most that mattered this morning in that first act as president, the inaugural address?
Well, first of all, I heard President Trump talking to his base, the people he referred to as the forgotten Americans. I don't know if I've heard as strongly a populist message as this one in an inaugural speech ever.
And you have campaigned for yourself for governor of the great state of Washington.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've appealed to my base and tried to expand it. But he didn't try to expand his base in his speech. This was a speech that was clearly written to reward and thank his base voters, those low propensity voters who turned out to vote for him in numbers that no one thought would happen, that got him elected. He got elected tactically the same way that President Obama did, by turning out larger numbers of low propensity voters from certain groups than anyone thought you could do. And that's why he won. And I also heard a very interesting message, you know, obviously focused on economics and on jobs. It was, again, targeted to that base. But I was reminded of something that I've thought about before, which is that his election clearly marks the end of the Reagan-Goldwater era of Republican politics. Trump is not a conservative in the traditional sense. He's a populist. I wondered at one point during his speech if he might someday be compared to FDR in the following way. FDR was often called the traitor to his class because he was a wealthy patriarch who turned around and went after the wealthy with his tax policies and other policies. And Trump may be viewed as a traitor to his class, to the extent his class is billionaires or people who believe in free markets and a free market economy, because he clearly intends to interfere in those free markets, to meddle, to impose government controls that we haven't seen since Richard Nixon. So that was striking to me. And the final point that really jumped out at me was the following. He at one point in his speech, about halfway through, he talked about defending our borders. And then there was a little pause. Then he said, from other countries stealing our jobs. I thought he was going to, of course, illegal immigration. He didn't. Mm-hmm. Maybe that was a deliberate, you know, little bit of misdirection. He went to other countries stealing our jobs, which brought him right back to that economic message. But interestingly, did not include a reference to illegal immigrants or undocumented workers at all. He was talking about national policy and an America First policy that is as strong a message as we've heard since Smoot-Hawley was adopted back in the early 1930s.
Okay, so one could interpret that as backing off some of his social rhetoric and focusing on jobs. We're going to take our first phone call in just a moment at 206-543-5869. Finally, Phyllis Fletcher, managing editor of the Northwest News Network. How did you translate Trump this morning?
It's a diss track, man.
A diss track. Yeah, okay. Explain.
One thing I can bring to this discussion is an encyclopedic knowledge of Howard Stern's career.
Uh-huh.
And this reminded me of the funerals he used to hold for morning zoo hosts in the 90s after he had beaten them in the ratings, like John DeBella and Mark and Brian. He would go to their town and he would have this event where it would be all about him and he would be saying, I told you I was going to do it and I did it. And he was like spiking the ball. And I never viewed an inauguration speech that way. I didn't think that's what they were for, but that's how he used this. And I've listened to hours and hours and hours of Trump on the campaign trail, editing stories and reporting on him when he appeared here in Washington State and in Oregon. And he used a lot of the same passages. I think probably even when you read the transcript, it pops out even more of just like, wait, I've heard him say that before. I've heard him say that. It very much sounded like a campaign speech, maybe an election night speech. It didn't sound very inaugural to me.
Our listener lines are open in reaction to this morning's presidential inauguration, 543-5869. Carla in Tacoma, what did you hear this morning?
You can correct me if I'm wrong on this statistic, but if you look at the nationwide vote, we have been saying that Mrs. Clinton won the vote and that Mr. Trump won the Electoral College. Take California out of that equation and the rest of the country voted for Trump because they felt the liberals had been taking us in the wrong direction. And I think Mr. Trump recognized that, President Trump, I should say now, he recognized that and he's responding to it. I think he maybe was a little surprised at how he resonated with the public. But now that he has, he's going to go forward and do the best that he can in the way that he sees it.
And did you hear anything this morning, Carla, in his first words, actually, as president, the speculation behind us? Did you hear anything this morning that gave you heart, gave you pause?
It gave me heart or pause?
Yeah.
It gave me heart when he talked about working on the infrastructure. Gave me pause. Right now I can't think of anything. But when he talked about the infrastructure, that resonated because it's been an issue here in our parts of the country for a long time. And I'm from what I can hear, the rest of the country also.
Finally, Carla, so you sound like you're a Trump supporter. What does his presidency call you to do, if anything? Do you act any differently now that it's Donald Trump painting this vision of where we're headed? Where do you head now, personally?
Well, sadly, most of my friends are liberals, and my opinion is because it's so easy to be a liberal. You break every rule, you vote in any amount of money you want, you ask somebody else to pay for it. What I have found that I have to do is be very, very careful about what I say and how vocal I am, because I know I will be shouted down. I have been shouted down just for even asking questions. And I think that's a very sad state of affairs.
Okay, then I want to ask one more thing. So, Carla, what you picked out was the end of voting to spend other people's money. If Donald Trump dramatically were to increase the national debt, would you regret your vote?
I don't know. I think that's kind of a loaded question. What's he going to do with the money? Is he going to cut anything else? It's hard to imagine that he'll just drastically increase it without making adjustments elsewhere. We've wanted for years to get out of the politicians in Washington. We've wanted fresh air. We have fresh air now, and all anybody has done is complain about it. Give the guy a chance. See what he does. I have a feeling that he's not going to increase the debt without reducing spending elsewhere.
Carla, thanks for calling us today from Tacoma.
Thank you.
206-543-5869. You noticed, Rob McKenna, that President Trump didn't mention undocumented immigrants in his speech. I noticed that he didn't mention anything about bringing down the debt, which is something that politicians used to talk about a lot. And he talked about spending a lot of money, infrastructure, railways and bridges, and where everyone's going to get insurance, as he said before. What do you expect the Trump debt effect is going to be?
He'll probably expand the debt. And that's consistent with his personal history. He's clearly not averse to debt. He's used it very skillfully and used bankruptcy, too. At the same time, his emphasis on infrastructure, which was the one clear policy initiative that he emphasized in his speech, one specific policy initiative, really feeds back into his pledge to create more jobs and put people back to work, particularly among those folks who've lost jobs in the manufacturing sector, many of whom moved into construction when construction was booming in the mid-2000s and then lost those jobs when the home construction industry particularly collapsed. So I think it's all very consistent for him in this speech.
KUOW, we're at 543-5869. More from Sherman Alexie and Phyllis Fletcher in a moment. Danny in South Park, how did you translate this morning's presidential inaugural address?
I think it was very hopeful. I know he was very much excoriating all the Republicans and Democrats, but he was speaking directly to the people of America, not to the politicians, not to the special interests, not to the moneyed bankers who basically bankrolled Hillary's campaign. I mean, I'm a Democrat. I was a Democrat all my life, and I've been praying for somebody that's different to be president as long as I can remember. And, you know, he's not perfect. He has his warts, but he is our president, and we have to support him. If we want America to succeed, we have to support our president.
That Danny, will you choose, you said hopeful. Will you choose one hope that you have for a Trump presidency, something that you'll hold him responsible for?
Oh, I'm definitely going to hold him responsible for the jobs.
Jobs.
We need to bring jobs back to this country. I've traveled all over this country. I've seen the shuttered factories. I've seen the dead towns. That is a real problem, despite what some people in the media try to paint. We will bring jobs back. Capitalism is a beautiful system, and we are creative. We may not get the jobs back that we had in the past, but we will be making new ones. The pie is not one pie. It's an infinite amount of pies. It's a pie factory. We will make more pies for all of our citizens. So, yeah, I'm very hopeful. Trump basically beat out all of the Republican establishment. You guys know that. They were against him. They weren't even for that guy. He beat the Democratic establishment. He beat the media. And, you know, even some of you guys over there are pretty critical of him in an unfair way. But, you know, that's your job. Hey, Sherman, I love your books, by the way. Give Trump a chance, will you?
Thank you, Danny.
All we are asking.
Yeah. That guy is taking his liberalism way too far.
How's that?
Singing Kumbaya with a little league dictator.
But listen, Sherman, you were frustrated during the campaign, but Danny is saying that now he's promising to bring back jobs, and he's either going to deliver or not. What's wrong with that?
You know, the amazing thing is, from both of those phone calls, the incredible disconnect between what they believe is happening and what is actually happening.
Well, it hasn't happened yet. He said he would hold Trump responsible for bringing back those jobs.
But both of those callers were talking about the moneyed interests controlling government and how they voted against that. And before he's even president, as he was assembling his inner advisors, as he was picking his secretaries, he was picking billionaires. He was picking the absolute people. He wasn't picking the politicians who are controlled by the billionaires. He's picking the billionaires who control the politicians. So he's just cutting out the middleman.
What do you have against successful people? Aren't you pretty well off yourself?
I'm not a billionaire. Uh-huh. But the thing is, I make enough money to know that people who complain about taxes are lying. I make enough money to know that the people who complain that they're oppressed because of their money are lying. I'm privileged enough to know that privilege is an amazing responsibility and it requires more of you. And that when you complain about it, it just reveals some callowness at heart. And the thing is, that's what's being laid bare here with his secretary choices. I mean, he's picking the worst possible, most unethical members of the capitalistic class possible. And amazing thing is, it's hard to believe he's doing this on purpose, but he is. I mean, every one of these candidates so far, with the exception of a couple of them, have had ethical problems that would have immediately disqualified them in previous years. But Trump has moved the discussion of morality so far out I can't even think of the words right now, that we've already accepted it. People have already accepted it. I've dumped conservative friends who didn't vote for Trump, but already beginning to accept him. And I'm dumping liberal friends who sound like the caller we just talked about. I mean, dissent is patriotic, and I'm going to dissent. And I didn't dissent. I didn't feel this way when Reagan was president. I didn't feel this way when both of the Bushes were president. I did not feel this way. I think Rob was getting at it. Trump actually exhibits the very worst characteristics of conservatism and the very worst characteristics of liberalism. He is a total monster on both ends of the spectrum, and he's incredibly dangerous.
We're listening back to and translating this morning's inaugural address by President Donald Trump. That is Sherman Alexie with Rob McKenna and Phyllis Fletcher. We're going to take a short break. We'll take more of your calls, and then we'll hear about a possible Trump effect in Olympia, Washington. So stay tuned. I'm Bill Radke, and on KUOW Seattle, this hour we are translating Donald Trump's inaugural speech, President Trump's speech, with best-selling writer Sherman Alexie, former Washington Attorney General Rob McKenna, and the managing editor of the Northwest News Network, Phyllis Fletcher. And you, we're taking your phone calls at 543-5869. 543-5869. Jesse in Columbia City, what did you hear this morning from your new president?
Basically, I just heard one of the most divisive nationalistic speeches I've ever heard in my life, and honestly, I was horrified.
How is it divisive?
I mean, basically, you know, my view of America has always been part of the world and accepting other people and working together, and that's the opposite of what he said. And I actually felt kind of like a fly on the wall, like in Hitler's early days, you know, before Jews were his problem. This is the kind of issues he was talking about, these nationalistic issues, these populist issues. And I just felt so chilled to the bone that this is the person that's going to be leading the free world.
Well, Jesse, Trump talked a lot about working together and said that, how did he put it, that there's no room for prejudice when patriotism is in your soul or something, and he called out to the black and the brown and the white people. What is it that he said? Is this just the way you felt coming in, regardless of anything he would have said, or did he say something today that changed your mind?
I mean, it was just the feeling of it made you scared. It made you uneasy of the future. And it's like, compared to listening to Obama, to listening to his speech, which is all about saying, you know, what a great country we are and what we need to do to fix problems. His view is sitting there in the middle of Washington, basically bashing Washington. You know, I value Washington as a citizen. I'm glad it's there, and I'm proud of that. And it seems like he wants to kind of, you know, make it seem like that is the problem, and somehow that's, and he's going to bring back these factory jobs. You know, it's total lies. He's not going to bring back those jobs, and I think people are going to see that in the next couple of years, and it's not going to take them long to realize that this is just all lies, and it's typical of a person that, you know, 85% of the things he says are false, are proved, like, they're just lies. So we're just listening to a person who lies, and I think, you know, as a country, we need to kind of rise up against this. This is the dark place that we're in.
Okay, he's not going to bring back the jobs, and Americans are going to see that. Jesse from Columbia City, thank you for that call. And let's talk about that, the idea that he's going to fail, and Americans are going to see that. Today, this week in his farewell news conference, President Obama talked about how, you know, he's saying reassuring things, we're going to be okay, and that some people wonder, could he really be so sanguine?
I've had some off-the-record conversations with some journalists where they said, okay, you seem like you're okay, but really, really, what are you thinking? And I've said, no, what I'm saying really is what I think. I believe in this country. I believe in the American people. It is true that behind closed doors, I curse more than I do publicly. And sometimes I get mad and frustrated like everybody else does. But at my core, I think we're going to be okay.
I think we're going to be okay. Rob McKenna, you were one of the day after the election, you and I talked, and I talked with several elected officials and others, and it was the people who had been in office, including you, who were the most sanguine about, and you were not a Trump supporter, but most sanguine. And I mean Ron Sims, Democrat, Jim McDermott, Democrat, and you basically said the office is bigger than the man. What do you say to Obama's saying, I really feel we're going to be okay?
Yeah, I think that President Obama, having held the job for 8 years, knows what he's talking about. He realizes the office is bigger than the man. Also, I think he continues to, you know, try to reassure people and be a voice of a more optimistic view and a more hopeful view, which is characteristic of his leadership style. I also think that you tend to get the results that you focus on. You don't get all of them. Obama accomplished a good deal of what he set out to do and accomplished a lot of things he didn't set out. You know, he did set out to do, didn't get them done. But, you know, it was because of his focus. So, for example, he really wanted to do something about health care and with Congress got the Affordable Care Act passed. Trump is going to get some things done that he says he wants to do. He is going to probably increase the number of manufacturing jobs through his policies. That is possible, contrary to the last caller's suggestion. He's already doing it by bullying American companies into bringing operations back from offshore.
Is that a mirage, or are those real gains?
Oh, I think they are. But remember, there's a cost to them. There's a reason that companies move manufacturing offshore. They do it to lower their cost and make products less expensive for American consumers and for overseas markets. So you can bring more auto manufacturing back to the country. You can bring maybe the Apple iPhone, although I'm skeptical of that. It'll make those products more expensive. And I think what Trump is implicitly saying is, well, we should pay more for stuff if it means more jobs stay here. He doesn't buy into the idea that you keep trying to drive down marginal cost as low as you can, even if that means exporting the jobs. At least that's the way I interpret what he says. So he can accomplish some of that. And the infrastructure projects that he wants to do, assuming he can get the tax increases through to pay for them, like a gas tax, will create jobs as well. So some of that will happen. And you can believe he'll take credit for it no matter how it happens.
So it's the we're going to be okay idea, which I said I heard from people who have actually been in office. Sherman, how do you know can you separate your personal reaction to Trump from the concept that maybe it's just going to be another presidency where your guy didn't win and the country moves on?
As a Native American who rose from extreme poverty to where I'm at now, most of what I've experienced in the country has been amazing. The celebration of the institutions and the government programs and the private corporations and everything that works together to make it possible for somebody like me to become who I am. So autobiographically speaking, I believe in the country. But Trump won by insulting all of that, by denigrating all of that. And his speech denigrated all of that. I mean, you say he talked to brown people. He didn't talk to brown people in the speech. He didn't talk to us.
He did. Well, in rhetoric, he did.
He referred to us as inner city.
No,
he did not mention anybody by race.
He did. He talked about brown, black, and white.
He talked about
it's time to remember that old wisdom our soldiers will never forget, that whether we are black or brown or white, we all bleed the same red blood of patriots. We all
That's not talking to us.
Okay. I'm telling you what he said.
It's referencing pre-20th century rhetoric. That's exactly pre-20th century rhetoric. I'm sure if we Google that right now, we'd find echoes of that in pre-20th century white power speech. He's not talking to us. And when he does talk about us, he talks about us in terms of our dysfunctions. Mm-hmm. He doesn't talk about us in terms of all that we've accomplished or the greatness of our communities. He only talks about us in the ways he thinks we have failed.
Yeah, and I just want to give, I can give some like speech writing critique to White Man of America. Whenever you start a phrase of your speech with, whether you're black, brown, we're just like—
Or polka dotted.
Yeah, stop that. Purple, green, bleh. Like, no, we know that that's nonsense. Like, please stop. And we don't feel spoken to when you do that. Absolutely not.
Phyllis Fletcher of the Northwest News Network, you were saying that you've noticed a possible Trump effect in Olympia. Will you let us know what happened and who we're about to hear from?
Yeah, you know, I think it was pointed out to me, the similarity between this. So I will not take credit for that original thought, but there was a press event where some lawmakers were addressing the press, and a reporter named John Stang asked Mark Schessler a question about education funding.
State Senate Majority Leader Mark Schessler.
Republican, yes.
When are you going to release your plan? Is it going to be 1 or 2 weeks, or are you going to wait until April to do it?
So, John, I think
none of your business. You're going to be the last one to know.
Okay.
Well, now is that a good response? I mean, he's a reporter representing his readers. It is his business. It's all of our business.
I'm going to answer the question.
I just think that was an unnecessary response.
Okay. Well, maybe it was.
What did that say to you, Phyllis?
Well, first of all, big ups to Rachel LaCourte, who's the woman we hear in that. She's a reporter for the Associated Press. She's been covering Olympia for the AP for years. And what she did is what I want to hear more of and what I think we're going to hear more of. We heard it last week, and this is the commonality with the Trump effect. I think of it as a press response to Trump effect. It's that when a source who has an obligation to the public says, I'm not going to answer that, or I'm not going to answer you as a colleague, whether you're competitors or not, you have an obligation to step up and get the question asked, and at least point out, if you can't get the question asked, at least point out, hey, that's bogus what you just did there. And big ups to Rachel on that. And Mark Schessler did write a statement later that said that was out of character for him, what he did, because if you know Olympia politics a little bit, you know that when John was saying, are you going to give us the plan now or in April? That's something that Mark Schessler interpreted as a dig, because right, April is so late in the session. And so that's this, like, you know, he Schessler says that's what got his back up, it was worth being pointed out that, he was using that as an opportunity to decline, answering and to say, well, you're going to be the last to know. And so when those adversarial things are set up, I feel like as a reporter, what I want to see is my person backing up the other reporter in the room.
KUOW's Olympia reporter works for her, Phyllis Fletcher, managing editor of the Northwest News Network. And back to the inaugural address of today, we're taking your phone calls. We're translating Trump. We have the full transcript of the speech in case, as Sherman Alexie, you boycotted with your ears and eyes, your ears anyway. You can read it and along with fact-checking all at KUOW.org. And we have a phone call now from Timothy in South Tacoma. Timothy, what did you hear this morning? Timothy, can you hear me? I think Timothy told us that he's basically a Trump supporter. Timothy, still with us? Okay, hopefully he'll get back with us at 206-543-5869. So we've been... I have other questions for listeners, by the way, which is I'm curious what you will do, Trump supporter or not, or in between. What will you do that you've never done before? Because, maybe you're a supporter and this is your call. This is now your country again. Start acting like it. What do you do differently? Or if you oppose Trump, is that just something you say? Or are you doing something that's new to you? And what is that? We're at 543-5869.
I have something
Phyllis?
I'm going to do differently. So I came up with this a couple nights after the election when I was talking with my friends and talking about things that were going to change if Trump followed through on what he said he would do. And he said he was going to dismantle the Affordable Care Act. And I have friends for sure who would not be alive or still in homes if they had not gotten to benefit from the Affordable Care Act. And I realized I could be in my 50s by the time the Trump administration is over. And so I decided with my friends that we're collectively going to lose 1,000 pounds.
Oh, yeah? That's what you're doing, huh?
That's right. It starts today. So I set up a spreadsheet. And I'm going to get in shape and lose some LBs and be in the best possible shape I can be in case my insurance situation should change, which I hope it doesn't. But you just never know.
Getting in shape for the Trump presidency. Sherman, are you doing anything differently?
I'm doing the same exact
thing. You want to be in our thing?
My wife and I have started essentially cooking everything, watching everything, watching my binging. I'm an emotional eater, and I'm going to be highly emotional for 4 to 8 years. I don't want to come out of this with diabetes.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a big guy, and I need to be a smaller guy. So certainly taking care of my health is one thing, especially because I'm going to be a public figure during all of this. I am going to have responsibilities. And now I'm just a writer, you know. But and you know, people get mad at me when I say that, but I am just a writer. Now, I can provide hope. I can provide, you know, spiritual relief. I can provide humor. I can provide all of that. But I can't do anything about the bureaucracy. All I can do is be a spiritual cheerleader. But in order to do that, I have to be healthy.
So I only have 6 people participating right now. So can we count your weight loss towards ours?
Start a new
club. We need help. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Rob looks great. Rob is.
Can't help him up there, Phyllis.
Rob is a slender, beautiful man.
Yeah, we're not talking to you. Yeah, I'm going to DM you on Twitter to.
I'm not on Twitter anymore. One of the things, too, is I dropped off Twitter. I think Twitter elected Trump. Very much so. I think the coarsening of our language, I think the lower expectations, I think the public display of liberal and conservative id, I think that more than any other thing, that factor, I think Twitter elected him. And so I dropped off of that because I don't want to support a system that brings out the worst in every single person on it.
You and Lindy West just disappointed a couple of 100,000 Twitter followers for very similar reasons as we interviewed her. And we're taking your call this morning, Howie in Seattle. Thanks for calling. And what did you hear? What was your translation of this morning's inaugural speech?
Well, thanks for having me on. And also, I just want to start off with I'm a Native American person, and I love Sherman Alexie. But also, I didn't listen. I didn't watch it because, again, I didn't want to give, just like Sherman, I did not want to give him the time of my day. But, man, if Twitter and Facebook didn't blow up in my face. And then I started listening to the program and heard some people talking and saying some stuff that just completely enraged me all of a sudden. And so what I think that what I've heard, and I'm assuming that he has continued to say since the beginning of his presidency, is that he doesn't care about me. He doesn't care about my family. And he doesn't care about my people. He doesn't care about brown people. And you know, in a country that, if you know history at all, is 100% founded on white supremacy, and it permeates every single part of it, even public radio, you know, it's a desperate time to be living if you're a Native person. We're some of the most vulnerable people out there. I'm a young Native American man who wears a hood and has a hat, and I get scared when I see cops. I have nephews and nieces, beautiful brown nephews and nieces, and it's a terrifying time to be alive right now.
Howie,
I know I love Obama, and I have critiques, but I can't think of any right now. But
Howie, can I get your reaction and the panel's to this? Here's an excerpt of Trump talking this morning, President Trump, about unity.
The Bible tells us how good and pleasant it is when God's people live together in unity. We must speak our minds openly, debate our disagreements honestly, but always pursue solidarity. When America is united, America is totally unstoppable.
How do you translate that, Howie?
Well, you know, first off, I'm not 100% sure that Trump can read, so that's impressive. But also, I guess I translate that as the way I say see colorblindness and the way I see people saying, you know, why can't you just pull up your own bootstraps and we can all get together and get behind the boat. I hear that that my problems are insignificant and I need to get top in line and get in a and get on board with whatever's happening and just move on past it.
Howie, thanks for calling today.
Thank you.
And stay tuned. Watch what the president does and stay in touch with us. We've heard from a couple of pro-Trump callers earlier in the hour, and we'd like to hear from more. What did you hear this morning that gave you encouragement or gave you pause. We're at 206-543-5869. Trump supporters, welcome.
You know, as a Catholic boy...
mm-hmm. Are you Catholic?
Vaguely. you know, it's very revealing. Again, in the speech, he referenced the Bible without referencing a verse.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, what he took from the Bible, I certainly am not as familiar with the Bible as a lot of people, but I can't even link that to a verse. The word solidarity?
Yeah, right.
You know, so, I mean, that's actually vaguely Marxist.
Right.
And so I thought, well, he doesn't read the Bible, and his speechwriter certainly doesn't read the Bible and is unfamiliar with it by not using a quote in the place where you would use a Bible quote when you said the Bible. Where's the verse? Where's the verse?
Well,
where's
see,
the verse?
There's going to be no division between Old Testament, New Testament. He's uniting us all in vagueness about the Bible.
That's one of the problems is the vague treatment of the Bible.
What was my man's name? Howie, who was just...
Howie.
Yeah, I'm glad he pointed that out because it's for sure when, you know, like he was making the analogy to people talking about color blindness. I don't see color. What we need right now is solidarity. If you're not on the same page as the person who's saying that, it definitely sounds like shut up, sit down. Especially as a person of color, if it's somebody saying, oh, here are all these policies that may marginalize you and your family and your friends, but what we need is solidarity. It's very much a shut up, sit down type of call.
Well, for better or worse, he did bring the Bible into the conversation.
Hey!
And
hey!
Catholic Rob McKenna, I believe.
Indeed. And that's a really good point, Sherman. He didn't cite a verse, but that's typical. He doesn't take a literary approach to his speech making, that's for sure. I was reminded when he said that of President Obama or candidate Obama's reference to people clinging to their guns and religion. And I thought, those people are on the mall today.
Mm-hmm.
And that remark about the Bible was for them.
The mall loved his speech. By the way, let's take another call. I want to ask you about your Catholic faith as it meets your stance on the death penalty. That's something that happened this week, so we'll talk about that with Rob McKenna in a moment. But we have a call from John in Bellevue. John, thanks for calling in, and what did you hear today that mattered to you from President Trump?
Well, thank you so much for taking my call, and I want to say first, I'm a conservative. Never voted for a Democrat in my life, except for this time. I voted for Hillary because I'm wary of Trump. But I hear so many people saying, and many of my liberal friends, very scared and all these protests and that sort of thing. I want to see. Let's see what he does. Let's see what his policies are going to be, because he said so many things and so many contradictory things. You can't really take what he says as what he's going to do. So let's see what his actions are. And then judge him from there.
And John, why is that important to you? Why would it be important for you to have your liberal friends and commentators drop the fear for now and give him a chance?
Well, to be open. Let's it is our one full country here. Let's be open to what is going to happen, what he's proposing.
How does being open help?
How does being open help?
Yeah, why is this important to you?
Well, because I want things to get better in the United States. I want the economy to improve. Unemployment to go down. All the participation rate to go up. Poverty to go down. All these sorts of things. Let's see what he does. So what is important to? Why is it important to me? So that whatever plans that he has. Let's see what they are and see what he does and see how that affects. Instead of just putting up, the hand, the Heisman to everything and trying and obstructing, which is what I heard all my liberal friends saying, for the last 8 years, Republican Congress is obstructionist. So now I guess Democrats are going to do that.
That's John in Bellevue. John, thanks for the call. John, echoing there, President Obama, who suggested in his farewell news conference that Trump opponents stop moping and act like his daughters, who understand that America is flawed.
And that they need to be active citizens. And they have to be in a position to talk to their friends and their teachers and their future coworkers in ways that try to shed some light as opposed to just generate a lot of sound and fury. They don't mope. But what makes me proudest about them is that they have also don't get cynical about it. They have not assumed because their side didn't win or because some of the values that they care about don't seem as if they were vindicated, that automatically America has somehow rejected them or rejected their values. Or I don't think they feel that way.
Sherman, are you a cynical moper?
I'm a parent, number one. I guarantee you Obama has no idea what his daughters are thinking. I mean, and the nerve of him to even speak for them in that capacity. That talk about patriarchal, way to go out on a patriarchal note, President Obama.
We have to take a short break, and we're back with Sherman Alexie, Phyllis Fletcher, and Rob McKenna, and you. Stay tuned. You've been listening to a special edition of KOW's Week in Review because we listened to President Trump's inaugural address this morning and we're reacting to it. I also want to turn, because we have Rob McKenna here, former Attorney General, who made news this week. By the way, Sherman Alexie, Phyllis Fletcher with us as well. Rob, you stood up with Washington's governor, as it turned out. He showed up at your news conference.
That wasn't planned.
Yeah, but you and the current attorney general and other Democrats and Republicans got together and called for an end to the death penalty in this state, which you have not advocated before in conjunction with a bill. You haven't supported a bill abolishing the death penalty. What turned you against it?
Well, it's been a long process. I've been a supporter of the death penalty, and as attorney general, the office worked hard to win appeals that were filed by death row inmates and have their sentences carried out. That happened once when I was AG. And over time, what's happened in my thinking is that I realized that we're at a stalemate here, that people are not being executed who are on death row, that these appeals go on for 15, 20, even 30 years. And I think that's bad for the system as a whole. It's corrosive of confidence in our criminal justice system. I have had friends talk to me and criticize me for giving in to the ACLU. You're letting these people win. That's not it at all. The entire system is weighted towards trying to prevent innocent people from being executed. And so there are lots and lots of appeal avenues. But it's gotten to the point now where in our state, it is unlikely that anyone on death row today is going to be executed anytime in the future. And I think it's sort of cynical to say, well, we should keep it on the books, even though really, we know it's not going to be used. Others who were at the press conference, like Mark Melosha, the Republican state senator, opposed the death penalty for moral reasons. They think that he's a strong Catholic. He's pro-life, and that, good for him. He's consistent. He's against abortion, and he's against the death penalty both. So everyone who comes to this seems to have their own unique take on their position against the death penalty or for the death penalty sometimes. I just think at a minimum that Attorney General Ferguson is right. It's time for the legislature to have a discussion about this issue, to debate it, and hopefully to take a vote on it. Because I think if it gets to the floor of the Senate and the House, the repeal will pass.
Is this another case of conservatives admitting that liberals were right, a la marijuana, same-sex marriage, death penalty?
Well, that's a really loaded question, Bill. I'm a little hurt, but that is of course why a lot of my conservative friends are very upset with me for taking this position, because they just feel like it's giving in to the other side. Put aside the policy merits of the debate, they don't like the idea that they think it means the other side wins. I just think I'm being pragmatic about it, not just in the sense that we're spending a ton of money on these cases that don't end up going anywhere, but also because I really do think it's inappropriate for to have a system where whether you even are charged with the crime that carries the death penalty and whether you receive the sentence of death depends a lot on where you live, because small counties cannot afford these cases, which is why Terry Neely, the Republican from Dayton, Washington in the southeast, a former Columbia County prosecutor, has also come out against the death penalty in favor of repeal.
Two more questions for you. Didn't Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer, his prosecutor use the death penalty as leverage to get him to confess to unsolved murders? And are you troubled by taking that away from prosecutors?
Yeah, that's probably the best argument that prosecutors and supporters of the death penalty have, is that it does give the prosecutors leverage, and it did give Norm Mailing leverage. But at the same time, But at the same time, I don't think you want your policy to be defined by one case or by even a small number of cases. And the fact is that you have to wonder about the ethics of, you know, threatening a penalty that will actually not even be carried out and that won't be threatened against you if you're from a small, poorer county as opposed to a bigger, wealthier county. So I agree that some leverage can result from the availability of the death penalty, but it's also important to remember that the number of aggravated murder cases that are charged to begin with are pretty small in this state.
Okay, one more. At the news conference, you said you get enough satisfaction knowing the Green River killer is, quote, rotting in solitary confinement, will live a miserable existence and will die in captivity.
So that goes to the issue of revenge, right? Some people support the death penalty because they think it would be satisfying to watch someone like Ridgway get the needle. And I don't share that view. I think I did it one time.
But aren't you enjoying the revenge of him rotting in solitary confinement?
What I'm saying is, look, this is not a vacation he's on. If you want someone to suffer and be punished, being locked up 23 hours a day in solitary is punitive. There's no question about it.
Okay, Phyllis Fletcher, do you have any sense? Our Olympia reporter Austin Jenkins works for you. Do you have a sense from him yet about the odds of a death penalty abolishment happening in Olympia?
Yeah, you know, we try to be very cautious about our crystal ball usage. But
that's fair.
Yeah, we haven't seen enough yet to sway us to think that it will pass.
Okay.
Yeah.
Basically agreed, McKenna?
Well, you know, we're taking it one step at a time. Okay. I agree with you. If you're standing where we are today, it wouldn't. However, the way this is going to work is we're going to get a hearing in the House Judiciary Committee, and then we're going to try very hard to get a vote in the House Judiciary Committee and get it moved. And that's what you have to do. And that would move it farther than it has been. It may take more than one legislative session for this particular coalition to get the bill moved along. But you got to start somewhere. And my showing up at that press conference and announcing my support for it is part of that start.
Sherman Alexie, any take?
I'm opposed to the death penalty for liberal and, I guess, conservative reasons. I mean, morally, I'm against it. But what is more big government than deciding which criminal gets to live and die? What is more? I mean, what could be more of a massive overuse of money and energy and resources than randomly deciding based on zip code, based on race of the victim, based on race of the perpetrator, deciding who lives and who dies? And also on a basic human level, I mean, when you said that, I saw that transcript when you said that about rotting forever, that I can deal with. that I can get with. You know, when Saddam Hussein was hanged, I was mad that he got hanged. I wanted him to put him in a tiny box and feed him power bars and water for the rest of his life. So you know, I'm not above vengeance.
No,
but I'm to decide who gets to live and die is the ultimate in arrogant government.
You made your spider hole, now lie in it.
Exactly.
That's Sherman Alexie with former Attorney General Rob McKenna and the managing editor of the Northwest News Network, Phyllis Fletcher. And we've been listening to the inaugural words of your new president, Donald Trump, and getting your reaction. Thank you for your phone calls. We will continue. We will listen, as some of our callers suggested. We will watch, and we'll hold your new president responsible, and we'll keep talking to you. So thanks for tuning in. And panel, thanks a lot for this hour.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you, Bill.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening.